Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm really delighted today to be with Neil Rolnick discussing his pioneering work in the 80s and 90s, which contributed to many of the developments in art and technology today. So, Neil, maybe you could introduce yourself briefly and then explain a little bit about your own career that led to the setting up of the program in New York.
Well, I was trained in the 60s and 70s as a classical composer and sort of the styles that were current then, which meant working with 12-tone systems and serialization and serialism and kind of trying to be as avant-garde as possible, and studied with Darius Milhaud. Had contact with Luciano Berio when I was quite young, and then after a sidetrack playing jazz and rock in the late 60s, early 70s, went back and got a doctorate at University of California at Berkeley.
So that was really very much in the modernist traditions, I guess you'd say?
Absolutely. And in fact, when I was at Berkeley is when I sort of uncovered, after being invited by Richard Feliciano, who wanted to study the newly developing computer music at a summer session at Stanford, wanted someone to kind of be on the interface for the computer with them. So he asked me if I would do that. And so that kind of got me hooked into Stanford and then through that to IRCOM.
And I guess that IRCOM stint was really the thing that really directed your interests and recontextualized them. You were there for about 18 months, is that right?
Yeah, 19 months. And I went there as a researcher. And it was the time at IRCOM when it was just being set up. I mean, my job basically was initially computers would come in, and these were for the most part like PDP-11 computers coming in the door, and I would work with often with Peppino DiGiunio to kind of get them hooked up, and he was in charge. I was sort of the helper. And working on getting things operating and working, and also then it developed into helping either composers or researchers do projects at IRCOM. I recall specifically a session where Harrison Birtwistle came over with his helper, who was John T. Harrison, who's developed into a fine, a wonderful composer. Barry said, "Okay, you guys, I want this kind of sound. I'll be in the cafe across the street. Give me a call when you come over and get me when you've got what I'm looking for." And we did that sort of thing an awful lot, which was great for a couple of things. One was that it certainly got me to roll up my sleeves and get dirty with the technology. So I was kind of hands-on all the time. And initially, I did a little bit of programming really in assembler language and had to get more of an understanding of what was going on technically than I had before. The other thing is it brought me into direct contact with the whole European tradition. I mean, it was a time at IRCOM when my direct boss was Gerald Bennett. The department heads included Luciano Berio, Jean-Claude Risset, Vinko Globakar. Pierre Boulez was a constant presence around, and kind of all of the European modernist royalty kind of came through, and it was really very interesting to me. I was kind of completely committed to that kind of music at that point. And I remember having discussions with some of the performers there who were interested in the Musique Americaine Repetitif, meaning at that point Reich and Glass, and I was pretty dismissive of all of that.
Let me just move the story along a little bit. Sure. So after that, those 19 months at IRCAM, in fact, I think you went around the United States looking at different programs and different things were going on.
Yeah.
Which provided you another context for the program that you set up at RPI. So maybe you can just explain that road trip and then the ideas that it led to in setting up the program at RPI.
Yeah, well, and when I finished my graduate work, I was broke and with my wife still in graduate school and a daughter who was about 4. And so when RPI offered the job to me in the fall of 1980, my wife was still in graduate school in California. The idea of being bi-coastal was not really operative then. And so I arranged for them to put off hiring me until January of 81 and to instead spend my salary on sending me around the country to figure out the current state of computer music at the time.
Just as a parenthesis, who at RPI was it that took the initiative of hiring you?
It was a guy named Larry Kagan, who's a wonderful sculptor who works, he just retired from RPI. He does work now with shadows and using scrap metal that he bends and makes shadows turn into line drawings. And he was sort of the... I was hired to replace a musicologist who I think had been, a high school teacher at one point and then kind of started teaching musicology at VI. What was presented to me when I was hired was that they wanted someone, A, who could build a program using technology, because technology at an engineering school was the right way to go in the arts. Yeah. And also that I should think of my position as being there as a working artist, and that it was understood that if I was teaching about music and composition and music and technology, that if I didn't continue making new work and performing, then I really had nothing to teach.
No. Well, what year did you start at RPI?
I did the road trip in the fall of 1980 and started actually working there in January of 81.
And where did you visit in that road trip?
The road trip took me, this will not be in any particular sequence. I remember visiting Bill Buxton in Toronto, who had just spent some time at Xerox PARC, and he showed me my very first mouse. He talked about it, and I thought, why is he so excited about mice running around his studio? So I made another stop in New York, and visited George Lewis, who was working with some of the little initial Yamaha modules that came off of the DX7, and where you could tune them. And he, what I recall is walking into his apartment in Manhattan Plaza, the artist housing over on the West Side, and he had this strange-sounding music being generated by a fourth computer hooked up to one of these Yamaha modules that was testing out different tuning ratios and different ways of tuning. So he would just fill the apartment for a day with a particular kind of tuning. I also visited New England Digital, up in Dartmouth. I visited makers of, there was a Krumar synthesizer, which was one of the early digital machines. I visited.
Well, in any case, yeah, so then when you got to RPI, you sort of had an idea of the American landscape at that point. And then
the American European landscapes, actually,
and the European landscape, obviously. And then in the article that you published in Leonardo, you mentioned then that John Sturgeon was hired, and Mark Resch, and a few other people. And so then the idea of the need for this MFA kind of emerged as an integrated arts MFA. Maybe you can explain those discussions a little
bit. Sure. Well, what happened was I started out teaching classes where I had two classes. I had a class where we got a few select students and built the studios. And then a lecture class in electronic music where I lectured and, you know, had people like Buxton or Don Buchla or David Behrman come in for a talk, and the students didn't care about it at all. They were just completely uninterested in the music that I wanted to teach them about. And John, when we hired him, ran into somewhat the same situation, a small core group that was interested and engaged technically, and then people who, when we talked about any kind of cutting edge art, were not, just didn't have any kind of background for it. And so when Mark joined us,
I have to chuckle because, as you know, we're setting up this program at the University of Texas, Dallas. My colleague Scott Gresham Lancaster says his first test question is, do you know who John Cage was?
Right.
And he always gets this blank expression.
Well, I would start out actually with, do you know who Wagner was? Do you know who Wagner was? And the answer, and it was all blank expressions. I had mixed feelings about being there in any case. I had gotten my doctorate because they paid for me and because it was a way to keep engaged with what I wanted to do, but my ambitions were always about being a composer. I didn't really want to be stuck in upstate New York, but I needed the job. When they offered it to me, it was clearly an opportunity to do something that could be interesting.
Neil, I'm just going to have to interrupt. Yep. We've got a couple of minutes left on this podcast, and obviously for the listeners, we'll carry over into the second podcast. Maybe you can leave us with a closing thought, which can lay the groundwork for the podcast about the creation of the MFA.
Okay, well, maybe the closing thought is that at the time that we actually had the discussions that came up that led to the beginning of the MFA and the IR Studios, our real question was what's going to make it interesting for us as professors to be at the school? And the answer was to try and build a community of people who was really engaged in the same sort of questions and ventures that we wanted to be involved in. And that sort of kicked it off.
Okay, very good. So with that thought, thank you, Neil, and we'll close this podcast and record the next one.
Thank you.